Thank you so much for watching. This is Corey from CoreyBakerFilmmaker.com, and I just rewatched 500 Days of Summer, written by Scott Neustadter, Michael H. Weber, and directed by Mark Webb. So first off, guys, I'm sorry that I was dark here for a little bit. I really wasn't prepared to not be able to go see movies in theaters, and I feel like that has sort of kept me from doing reviews. I didn't know exactly how I wanted to approach the idea of watching things that were in my catalog or something like that, in my DVD collection. Throughout this time in quarantine, I have been writing a lot more, and part of my process when I go through writing, especially when I'm thinking about writing as far as directing something later, is largely based off of, like, getting the feel. Like, so much of film is about figuring out what works and how it reaches you and how it impacts other people. And I feel like that is something that you learn a lot from just watching other films. You just learn other people's mistakes. You learn what worked. You learn what didn't work. And not every movie fits that criteria. Like, not every movie is going to teach you about the movie that you're about to make. But I went into this whole process of reviewing some of these movies with the idea that these are things that I'm thinking of while I'm also in the process of writing the script and coming up with ways that I could direct it. And that whole process sort of led me to this idea where I will sort of pick out things that have inspired me or that I'm thinking about. I'm not quite ready to talk about the project and what it involves right now, but I will tell you this, that 500 Days of Summer seems like it's a very huge leap away from where I will eventually settle. But part of what made me want to watch this movie so much and, like, sort of catch up on it was the idea that it plays with the nonlinear timeline and it sort of jumps around. And for me, that was very important as a potential way of handling the story that I'm writing. So here I am, rewatching 500 Days of Summer and telling you all about it. So I'll tell you up front, I am a huge fan of 500 Days of Summer. I've always put it in, like, my top five favorite movies. I think you will find, despite that fact, that when we get to the Legacy Leaderboard later on in the show, that there will be some things that will surprise you. But I have loved this movie since the moment I saw it. I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it on DVD, I think. Like, I'm pretty sure somebody told me to watch it, and I started watching it, and then it took me like 5 minutes to realize I had to buy it, and then I watched it 100 times since then. I have the 500 Days of Summer movie poster hanging over top my monitor. Clearly, right now, I'm wearing my 500 Days of Summer shirt that I got at the Redwood Bar when they did the 10-year anniversary. That is the bar at the beginning of the movie where they do the karaoke. And that was a really awesome experience. I thoroughly love this movie. And I'm so excited to tell you all about it and my thoughts. So there's a lot of things about this movie which are unique and interesting, which really make it so fascinating to look at as sort of like a case study into screenwriting. So in the first couple minutes of the movie, right leading up to the music that's playing through the opening credits, they tell you this is not a love story. Like, this is a story of boy and girl, but this is not a love story. And despite the fact that it's one of the first things that we're told in the course of the movie, we forget about that almost immediately. We move on so quickly into believing that Tom and Summer deserve to be together for some cosmic reason. All the tropes of a romantic comedy keep forcing lesser judgment into our minds, despite the fact that we've been told the entire time by the narrator up front, by Summer herself, this is not going to work. And I think it's brilliant because I fell for it too. I mean, like, admittedly, I watched the movie and I kept saying, like, oh, well, you know, they broke up at 290 days. So what, you know, what's the rest of the five? I quickly realized that the, you know, the numbers going up and forth with the number of days, it's pretty clear. And once you realize that, like, the breakup happens at 290, and where's the redemption? Where's the rest of the story? And you keep thinking that it's around the corner. And it's just because this movie is so good at being able to take things and treat them the same way that we process memory. So, towards the end of the movie, when they're going to Millie's wedding, you know, they have the moment where they see each other on the train. Hey, do you want to go get a coffee, catch up? And then they go back to the back of the train, and then the Temper Trap song plays. And it's just sort of a montage of the two of them having playful exchange. But you don't know what it is. You can't hear it. All of it's just sort of like lost in the ether of the moment. But that's sort of how you would remember it if you were explaining it to somebody in real life. Like, you know, like, oh, and then I was going to the wedding and I saw my ex-girlfriend and she got on the train and she came up and said something. And then we got a coffee and we talked for a bit. And then eventually we got to the wedding. Like, I just skipped over what we talked about when we were having the coffee in the train. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, like, we could have been talking about, like, the weather or some shit like that. Like, it doesn't mean that it has to narratively fit inside the story. And I just really enjoyed the fact that this movie is not only faithful to a structure, but it's also completely not faithful to it. I mean, like, what's... The narrator, for one, is great. And it's the type of thing, like, if you read screenwriting books, they might tell you, don't put in a narrator, because it takes people out of the movie. The narrator pops in at the beginning of the movie. He sort of sets things up. He leaves until about, you know, 40 minutes in or something like that for just, like, a quick little rejoinder. And then he comes back one more time with the expectation versus reality bit. And then at the end of the movie, in the last scene after we've seen Summer for the last time, it's sparingly used. And it's funny, and you hardly even notice it. This movie is incredible in the fact that not only does it tell you the ending up front, and you don't believe it, and you fight it the whole entire time, but it also sets itself up like it's a romantic comedy, even though it's very much not a romantic comedy. And we all fall for it. Like, it's the most aware of itself movie that is also trying to be completely unaware of itself at the same. It's a walking paradox, but in all the most wonderful ways. So, talking about it from a screenwriting perspective, I mean, this movie follows, you know, all the general rules while also being in the nonlinear timeline, which sort of throws wrenches in the works. So, for instance, the first 40 minutes of the movie leading up to when the narrator comes back for the first time in a while, you know, we're basically playing out the first 120 days or so of the relationship, like the first 4 months or so. And we jump back and forth a little bit, but we never go past 300 or so days in that first 40 minutes of the movie. So we're staying roughly within the first 60% of the movie. And honestly, rewatching it last night, it dawned on me that we don't really jump out too much. It's just sort of like a quick pop-in rather than we're living in this moment later in the movie. It's just sort of to show the differences between how he feels about being fresh in love in the beginning and towards the end when he is broken and awful inside. When we get to, like, the hour marker in the movie, we skip ahead from where we've been living in the first 9 months of the relationship and go all the way up to 400. So there's a humongous jump where we're leaving the undetermined part of the story to be what caused the breakup and what got us to this point. And by not having it, it makes you just blind to the idea that they're going to get back together and that they're going to be happy ever after and everything like that. And obviously going right into the wedding where, you know, they're dancing and they're having fun and they're doing their old tricks and stuff like that. towards the end of the movie, when we finally get past basically everything, we get to the expectation reality, there's a real hard break in the way things are handled from that point on. And we finally get to go back and examine what happened in the breakup time of, you know, 290 and beyond. And then finally catching up with the end of the story sort of in real time, with the last couple scenes to get us up to the 500th day of summer. One thing I wanted to touch on before moving on to sort of generalized topics here is that the end of the movie, and in particular the line, they're going back and forth about, you didn't want to be in a serious relationship with me and now you're married. I don't think I'll ever understand that. There's one line where Summer says in him, I knew what I never was sure with you. What I was never sure of with you. Sorry. And that line then, and every single time I've watched this movie, has just hit me like a dagger right in the heart. And it is so powerful, and it really sits in this interesting and complex way. And there are theories out there that the last time that Tom actually sees Summer is at the Realities vs. Expectation party at her house, and that this is sort of just like a figment of his imagination of her showing up at Angel's Knoll like that. By the way, not Angeles Plaza. Angeles Plaza is the senior facility down the block. It's Angel's Knoll, where Angel's Flight is at the Cal Center, One Cal. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a figment of the imagination. I think she had to say that line to him to make it clear, even though she's married, even though he seems to be in a better place, and even though there doesn't seem to be any hard feelings and like trying to win her back kind of thing going on here, she still needed to make it perfectly clear. This is done. And it's not because you're not a great guy. It's just because I found what I was looking for and it wasn't you. And she had to be frank to make that moment really sit. And I there's a couple lines in movie history that like really stick with me, and this is one of them. And every single time I hate her a little bit for saying that to him, but at the same time I completely understand where she's coming from and get what she's trying to accomplish with it. A couple general thoughts. I think that the acting in this movie, and particularly the casting in this movie, is very well done. I don't know if I would say that anyone in this movie necessarily puts on the best performance of their career, or rather, the best that I think that they would potentially be capable of. I think that both Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zooey Deschanel are doing the best work that they were capable of doing at this exact moment in time. I don't know if it's the best work that they'll ever be capable of doing, but there's it's not like it's, you know, award worthy acting. Like, it really transcends and breaks through. But I mean, in the world of this piece, all these characters are pitch perfect. And could you have a bigger name? Could you have a better actor, like all these sorts of things? Sure, you could, but I really think that they did everything exactly the way it needed to be played. And if you start doing the alternative casting theory of like, what if it was somebody else other than Zooey Deschanel? What if it was somebody else other than Joseph Gordon-Levitt? What if, you know, like going down the line, like if you take one of these pieces away, then it makes the rest of the structure less sound. And maybe it's better, and maybe it improves everything, but you don't know. And we know how this one turned out, and I doubt anyone is upset with that in the end. One other thing, the soundtrack on this one is great. And I don't spend a lot of time talking about soundtracks because, generally speaking, I feel like my barometer of whether or not your soundtrack really broke through is if I'm going to purchase it or, like, you know, get it on Spotify or something like that. There has to be some sort of effort made by me to obtain the soundtrack and be able to listen to it later. And for that one, for this movie, I did. When I first saw the movie, I bought the soundtrack because it is filled with incredible music. And it's not that it's like the best music ever, but it is really great music that is pitch perfect for the movie that they're telling, and specifically the feel of the characters and their sort of Echo Parky sort of nouveau liberalism. And I've sort of, you know, said that everyone in this cast is really great, all the way down. I feel like they got incredible people everywhere. I would like to shine a light on Micah Kelly, though, at the end, because she is able to do in one scene really incredible work of just making us feel connected to her in the way that we need to for the story to work, and for us to feel like Tom has a future with her. And to do that in, you know, less than 5 minutes at the tail end of the movie in this one scene is a lot harder than it seems. And she deserves a lot of credit for that. And I, you know, it's incredible that this movie has people sort of like her being able to step in and knock it out of the park with these little tiny performances. And this whole movie is just filled with it. One last thing before we get out of here. I feel like I need to talk a little bit about sort of the controversy of this film, if you will. After it was released, it was generally loved right away. And then after a little bit of time came this view that, you know, this movie is overly male-centric and that Zooey Deschanel's character has very little substance to her and very little backstory, and it's not like we really care about her, and she's merely just a object of affection for Tom, and all of this that sort of goes in with it. And I get where these opinions come from. I would like to say in rebuttal to that that that's the point. I mean, Tom is not of the maturity to have a relationship like this at this time. And he needs to, if this story, this movie that we're watching is being used in parts as like sort of the memory of Tom in this, of course he's going to only remember casual little things about her. He's not going to remember, oh, that time we talked about her old relationships. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, that might be something that gets brought up in a conversation with other people, but, like, you know, you don't talk about her life necessarily when you're going back over the details of what had been. That being said, when this movie was released, I was 25, and I was in a relationship with a woman that I had convinced myself that she was it. I had fallen in love, and I wasn't going to throw out the word love for anybody, and this is the one where I felt it. And we, much like Tom and Summer, had a 10-month-long relationship or something like that, where the effects of it continued long after, and the age of Summer was felt in the same sort of regard, personally speaking. Tom is at this point, and it's a very specific type of relationship. When you're in your mid-20s and you feel like you're an adult now, and that you should be figuring out the person I'm going to spend the rest of my life with, and marriage, and all the other things that go along with it, I get it. And Tom just wants to check off that box so desperately. And despite the fact that everything that we do get from Summer, even though her development as a character is lighter, everything we do get from her is, I don't want a serious relationship. I just want to be friends. I, you know, like, and Tom fights back on some of these ideas, like, you know, like shower sex, that's not a friend thing. But she's fairly clear with him the entire way through. I don't want a serious relationship. And when they do break up at the end of the thing, with the, after seeing The Graduate, you can watch and see that Tom just doesn't get it. She's trying to peacefully back out of this situation. She is not in the mood to deal with Tom anymore right now, and it's not that she doesn't love Tom and doesn't want to spend time with him. It's just that the movie hit her in the way that it hits most people, and Tom doesn't have the same sort of reaction to The Graduate. So she is going to try and get out, and he just keeps bringing it up. Like, you know, like, oh, let's get something to eat. No, I'm okay. I think I'm just going to go back. Oh, I got it. Pancakes. And now that he's forcing it upon her to, like, sort of stay and deal with this moment, she's going to break up with him. And we can make arguments all day about whether or not, you know, the 10 months of summer that was the actual relationship is deserving of so much foundation in Tom's life, but it just seems like this is the story of, it's a love story, but way before, it's the prologue to the love story. It's telling you how you molded yourself to eventually become the person that you would become. And I think that Tom, generally speaking, you can tell that he's a kind soul, and I think that he will, in the end, find more happy and healthy relationships. But this one was not happy and healthy solely because of his actions. It had nothing to do with Summer. And the lack of anything that makes us feel deeper for the character of Summer is solely based off of Tom's internalizing as to what's important. And what's important is Tom. And he has some serious issues that he's trying to work out. And I don't think it's fair to try and put the same sort of spotlight you would on other movies that are trying to tackle the idea of love with the same vigor, because this is just a very different type of story. It's very smart, and it's very deep, and it's very clever, but it's not meant to stand up to the rigors of every single relationship benchmark that you want to put into this movie. This over here, it's a parking lot. That thing? That's a leaderboard. And a blank leaderboard, because I'm doing a legacy leaderboard for this. Now, so I've been trying to figure out the exact rules that I want to put by this, but generally speaking, I feel like I want to have at least 10 years since the movie was released before it can find its way onto the legacy leaderboard. Simply because movies over the first 10 years that they're out sort of change a lot. I wish that we actually had an Oscars which was 10 years after the movie had been released, so we can properly think about how much it, the importance it has in the grand scheme of thing. I mean, I think that, you know, not to pick on it, but movies like The Artist would probably not be nominated for the Academy Award 10 years after the fact. It just doesn't have the same staying power as other movies that were released at the same time. I was really upset when I saw the Oscar nominations and 500 Days of Summer wasn't nominated for anything. I would say that it's very worthy of a screenplay. And, you know, like, editing would have been good, but the money at play here of trying to get an indie movie to get Oscar nominations is already a humongous financial commitment. And even though it's Fox Searchlight, it clearly seemed it wasn't in the cards. That being said, I still think that this movie is criminally underappreciated, and the best way to watch it is multiple times and pick a different character to follow the perspective of. Because the first time you watch this movie being on Summer's side of the whole thing, you're going to realize all these secret little gems that you never saw before. That being said, I want to... it's time for the rating here. And as I said, it's one of my top five favorite movies I've ever seen. That being said, I would give 500 Days of Summer a 9.1. Now, I would imagine that people would probably watch this and say that it deserves to be higher if it's one of my favorite movies, but I'm trying to be fair with how I would judge it against other things. And just because you like a subject matter of something, or because you like the type of movie, or because you like what they did, the style, blah, 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 doesn't necessarily mean that the movie is the best thing that ever got made. I really do think that it's a beautiful, wonderfully done movie with incredible performances, but it just doesn't, it doesn't need it for this movie to work, but it doesn't have anything that really breaks out. There's not a award-turning performance. There's not a incredible moments that like lives on in the conversation forever. I mean, like, there's things about 500 Days of Summer, like the Hall & Oates song and the dance number, which I feel like live on more than anything else in the movie. And while it's a great moment, it's not what I necessarily think of when I think of the movie. But yes, I would give 500 Days of Summer a 9.1. And thank you so much for watching. You can find more of me at my website, CoreyBakerFilmmaker.com, Facebook.com/CoreyBakerFilm, at LegendCB5 on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. I'm going to do more of these, talking about movies that are sort of inspiring me along the process of working on the script that I'm working on right now. Believe me, when I'm ready to talk more about it, I will do so here and in the various other places that I post things. But if you have an idea of something for me to watch, I would not be against suggestions. So if there's something you'd like my take on or whatever, just any movie, just throw it out there and I'll let you know. I'll see what I can do. Anyway, thank you so much for watching. If you don't mind, I have to go to a bench in Angels Knoll and just wait until somebody kicks me out, because that park's been closed.